This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you'd like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
High-frequency radars now working for real. For the first time, really useful high-frequency over-the-horizon radars are being built. Michael Payne reports in Electronics Weekly. Every so often, somebody in public life gets wind of a mysterious technique called over-the-horizon radar. Supposedly capable of detecting an aircraft movement or a missile launch thousands of miles away, i.e. in Russia, and on which government scientists are said to be working in the greatest secrecy. Questions are asked in Parliament, but ministers stonewall, and for a week or two, gee whiz media persons enjoy themselves speculating. On the best-known occasion, in 1971-72, some tall radio masts were built on the Suffolk coast at Orford Ness, and fishermen were told it was dangerous to fish close inshore. The United States Air Force was said to be the owner, RCA the builder and operator. Somebody claimed that a line drawn on a map from Orford Ness to some similar masts in Australia passed through a Soviet intercontinental ballistic missile test site. In 1973, the Orford Ness site closed suddenly and everybody went home. No authoritative statement was ever made. Recently, the Labour MP Brian Wilson asked the Minister for Defence, George Younger, in a parliamentary question if the Ministry of Defence is collaborating with the Americans on over-the-horizon radar, and, in particular, if the United States Navy is to have an over-the-horizon radar site in Britain. He also asked if the Ministry of Defence will buy an over-the-horizon radar. The minister said Anglo-American studies are going on, quote, but there are no firm plans, etc. Over-the-horizon radar uses frequencies in the HF band, say between 3 MHz and 30 MHz, and is sometimes called HF radar. Ordinary radar uses microwave frequencies above 1 GHz normally. Microwave frequencies can give high resolution of targets, but the transmission cannot be made to deviate significantly from a straight line, so normally there is no way a microwave radar at ground level can detect normally a low-flying aircraft more than a few tens of miles away because of the curve of the surface of the Earth. Lower frequencies, however, can be made to follow the curve of the Earth to a greater or lesser extent, and so detect a low-flying, even a surface target over the horizon. High-frequencies offer the best compromise between resolution, for which a short wavelength is desirable, and the ease with which transmissions can be made to follow the Earth's curvature. If the wave is polarized vertically and transmitted over the sea, the electromagnetic wave and the sea surface interact in a way that bends the path of the transmission to follow the sea surface. Targets will reflect radiation back towards the transmitter, as do targets caught by microwave radar. The continuous interaction between radio wave and sea wave attenuates the power of transmission, but ranges of several hundred miles are practicable. Detection in this way is called surface wave over the horizon radar. If the wave is polarized horizontally and transmitted upwards at an angle, it will be reflected back to Earth by the ionosphere. If the angle is chosen carefully and ionospheric conditions are suitable, the beam can be made to make contact again with the Earth thousands of miles from the transmitter. By that time, the ground or sea area illuminated will be large and targets on it will reflect returns. This type of detection is called skywave over the horizon radar. The reflection will be backscattered towards the transmitter and also forward scattered in the same direction as the transmission, in both cases reaching Earth via the ionosphere. Forward scattering was the notion behind the theory that the Orford Ness transmissions were intended for reception in Australia. Over-the-horizon radar is not easy to implement. The signals reflected from targets are very weak by the time they reach the receiver. Ordinary galactic atmospheric and man-made noise can swamp them, and in surface wave over-the-horizon radar, sea clutter returns can exceed target returns by 80 decibels. Targets are extracted from noise by spectral analysis of the receiver output. This process identifies phase-coherent portions of consecutive return pulses. It then adds them until the target return builds up above the noise, which is not phase-coherent from pulse to pulse, and so does not add. Sea clutter is caused by the movement of waves and is removed by Doppler filtering. This can bring problems when a wanted surface target, such as a ship, is moving at around the same speed as the waves. The ionosphere, on which skywave over the horizon radar depends, is always in a fluid state, which makes the assumptions about its state, on which the technique depends, very difficult. The answer is continuous real-time radio probing, so that the over-the-horizon radar operating variables can be changed to follow the ionospheric changes. High-frequency channels are widely used for radio communication, and over-the-horizon radar has to use channels allocated to it, but also available to communications users. Over-the-horizon radar requires a channel exclusively for at least several seconds, but there is no way exclusivity can be guaranteed. Consequently, HF communications usage is tabulated and mapped to indicate the OTHR channels likely to be free at given times and places. During operation, the channels are probed continuously to find the most likely quiet frequencies. From the communications user's point of view, over-the-horizon radar must not interfere with communication. This means the transmissions must have very low side lobes and the transmitter very high spectral purity. The solutions to these problems depend on extensive and advanced digital technology, particularly signal processing to do the spectral analysis and synthesis, and filtering to discriminate the Doppler frequencies. These techniques are becoming available at an economic price. In the United States, General Electric of America has built for the United States Air Force a SkyWave over-the-horizon radar to survey a large part of the North Atlantic from sites in Maine. Three transmitting antenna arrays each cover an azimuth sector of 60 degrees, providing 180 degrees of coverage extending northeast to Greenland and southwest to Cuba. Maximum range is 2,000 miles, minimum range 500 miles. It is a frequency-modulated continuous wave radar, and the block of sea surface and space volume above it investigated at any instant is variable in the range dimension up to 500 miles, and in azimuth in steps from 7.5 degrees to 30 degrees. The total coverage area is surveyed in stages. The receiver antennas are separate but nearby, that is, it is a backscatter radar. Operating frequencies are selectable between 6.7 MHz and 22.3 MHz. The radar is not intended to track and identify every target in the manner of an air traffic control radar, but rather to detect and track an aircraft such as a backfire bomber or a cruise missile whose presence is not scheduled and expected. It acts as a very early warning cue for more precise detection, tracking, identification and fire control radar systems. GE in the United Kingdom is building a similar radar on the US West Coast. In Britain, OTHR work has concentrated on less expensive surface wave technology that could provide detection ranges of a few hundred miles. Such systems would be useful around the British coast, but not overland, because of the necessary interaction between the radio wave and the sea. Marconi Radar has built a surface wave pulse Doppler over the horizon radar on a site on the southeast coast, which has shown it can detect a Canberra bomber flying at low level underneath any likely microwave radar beam. It was described by Ken Perry and John Bordoini of Marconi Radar at a recent conference at the Institution of Electrical Engineers. Perry showed over-the-horizon radar tracks of civil aircraft outbound and inbound over the coast, and they corresponded well with the air lanes. He said the trials were repeated in widely varying sea states using aircraft and a special reflector installed across the North Sea, and the level of returns stayed constant. This is important because of the interdependence of radio wave and sea surface. The trials used the band 4 MHz to 8 MHz. A transmit array of four antennas is fed by four power amplifiers with variable relative phase for beam steering over 90 degrees. There is a separate receive array with eight ports converted by a beamformer into six overlapping receive beams. A target return appears in more than one beam, and comparison of signal amplitudes improves computation of the bearing. Perry says the arrays have to be low down, and preferably on a saltwater marsh, to ensure good coupling between the antenna ground plane and the sea. The HF wavelength is long, and the arrays have to be long enough to keep the beam width reasonable. They must be able to look out to sea through a reasonable coverage angle. It can be hard to find good sites which are available. Also, the metal for the antennas must be chosen carefully because corrosion products are semiconductors and can have extraordinary effects. A long pulse of 250 microseconds is used to get sufficient HF power on the target. The trial's radar beam is wide by microwave radar standards. The combined effect is in exact spatial resolution. The range azimuth cells are roughly 20 kilometers square. However, Doppler processing fixes the radial velocity of a typical aircraft within 2 knots, and Perry thinks this good Doppler performance, together with comparison of signal amplitudes across adjacent range azimuth cells, can be exploited to improve range accuracy to a few kilometers. Future surface wave radars may put out a lot of power, up to 200 kilowatts, through high-gain antennas, and the authorities that regulate spectrum usage will have to be convinced transmissions will not interfere with HF communications. This means the spectrum of the transmitted signal will have to be tightly controlled to avoid overlap with adjacent channels and sideband reflections from the sea minimised. The demonstration radar uses a Hewlett-Packard frequency synthesizer. This is stable with low close-to-carrier phase noise, which is an essential characteristic for accurate analysis of the returned pulse spectrum. The 10 kilowatt power amplifiers from Marconi Communication Systems also have low phase noise and intermodulation product levels. The phase relationship between the amplifiers is closely controlled by referencing the output to the input to correct incipient error. The 6 receivers following the beamformer have dynamic ranges approaching 100 dB to cope with the enormous sea clutter at the top end and the minute amplitude of wanted signals at the bottom end. Marconi communication receivers were specially modified. The wanted signals are retrieved from noise and discriminated from sea wave clutter using digital processors. For each range cell, data from more than 8,000 pulse returns is collected over an integration period of typically 16 seconds. It is digitized and structured into 4,096 points for subjection to a fast Fourier transform. This produces the basis for phase-coherent summing and Doppler filtering to discriminate fast-moving aircraft from slow-moving C-wave fronts. 4 integrations overlap, so that incoming data is updated every 4 seconds. The thresholds above which an apparent target is assumed genuine are adjusted continuously in the processing by continuing evaluation of overall noise and clutter levels. The trials suggest that a surface wave over the horizon radar could be built for detection of low-flying aircraft over ranges to a few hundred kilometres at least.
Thank you. grabbed my hat, looked that girl in the eye. Where's your home? What's your phone number? Stop fooling around. Could have died, she replied, I'm the wife of the clown. Ha ha, said the clown. As the king lost his crown, is the knight being tied on romance?
Innovative information-based radio broadcasting to the people who really listen to shortwave. This is Radio Facts, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
And now a broadcast satellite launch covered by Media Network on Radio Netherlands.
An Ariane 2 rocket successfully put a French direct broadcast satellite into orbit.
What a beautiful liftoff.
19 minutes, 22 seconds after launch came the moment the European Space Agency had been waiting for.
We have separation of the satellite.
And hours later, the solar panels unfolded, and for the moment, everything looks good. Except that the satellite itself has been delayed so many times, the technology it employs is outdated. As yet, although there are five transponders, there's not yet a full complement of confirmed customers who want to have their programs broadcast. The TV transmission standard will be D2 MAC, but as yet, suitable receivers are not in the French domestic marketplace. Meanwhile, the Super Channel network has been saved from collapse again this past week. The station is said to have lost something in the region of £60 million since it started. The Super Channel News on Tuesday had details of the latest takeover bid.
There's been a change in the ownership of Super Channel. The Italian organisation Beta Television has become the majority owner of the channel. The record and airline group Virgin will still be involved in the channel. They'll have 45% of the shares. But that's all for now. Goodbye.
Jonathan Marks there on Radio Netherlands Media Network, which is transmitted on Thursdays. The best time to receive it in the British Isles is 11:51 UTC on 5955. On the Channel 4 television programme Signals, Sex on Television, What's All the Fuss About?, the difference between the regulatory procedures for Channel 4 and ITV Network, both covered by the IBA and the Broadcasting Act, was explained.
Oh, Channel 4 are their own arbiters. We can only recommend a certification to Channel 4.
Channel 4 is in fact also bound by the Broadcasting Act and the IBA guidelines, but it interprets them more liberally than the ITV companies for whom Ken Fletcher works.
Since sex happens in private, that always has to be the most overwhelmingly powerful artistic justification or expository justification for such depiction. But we started from the basis that it couldn't be left out and that it would therefore be the programs that we made, and almost more importantly, in a way, the films that we showed, provided they were films of merit and repute and not just dirty movies, we wouldn't try to take the naughty bits out, we'd leave them in.
Jeremy Isaac speaking there, who launched Channel 4. The programme then went on to discuss the on-screen red warning triangle, which was used by Channel 4 for certain films, with Mary Whitehouse.
The point of the red triangles was to warn viewers. Go on.
Yes, but it was so silly, wasn't it? The viewing figures for the previous series had been 800,000, right? Red triangle was put on to warn people because there had been objections about this. All right, well, we'll put a red triangle on. That's to warn you. So you switch off or you don't watch. the viewing figures went up to 2 million or just under 2 million. I mean, you're not going to tell me that they didn't know, out of all their experiences, if they put a red triangle on. That's the nature of man and perhaps women as well, that when they're warned off, they want to see what it's all about.
She's right about that. If you put out a warning, even on the night, just before a programme, that it's a bit strong, you get, I mean, I used to say, and I'm sure it's right, people yell out, come on, granny, come downstairs, there's something interesting on. And this is because Mrs. Whitehouse consistently, absolutely consistently, misreads the views and preferences of the British public. She simply does not understand that people benefit from and therefore welcome a frankness about difficult subject matter on television and don't want to be protected from it.
Jeremy Isaacs there, ending those items from the Signals television programme presented by Michael Cockrell. And now a million-selling single with Eddie Caffrey.
Badfinger, Come and Get It, released on the Apple record label on both sides of the Atlantic in early 1970. Its original UK catalogue number was Apple 20, coupled with Rock of All Ages on the B-side. Come and Get It was written by Paul McCartney of The Beatles. It was recorded by the group for the film The Magic Christian, when they were still known as The Ivies. The Beatles changed their name to Badfinger. And Badfinger were signed to the Apple organisation and were launched with a massive campaign. But nothing happened until Paul McCartney wrote Come and Get It and produced the disc for them. This was released in January 1970, reaching number 3 for 1 week on both sides of the Atlantic. It had a bigger sale in the USA, where it sold a million copies. This group had a vocal sound that set them apart. The personnel of Badfinger were Pete Ham on guitar, piano, organ, born 27th April 1947 in Swansea, Wales. Mike Gibbons on drums, guitar, born 12th March 1949 in Swansea, Wales. Tom Evans on guitar, piano, bass, born June 21st 1947 in Liverpool. Joe Mulland playing guitar, piano and bass, born June 21st, also in 1947 in Liverpool. He joined the group after they cut Come and Get It. Badfinger had their first big date at the famous Cavern in Liverpool. Sadly, Pete Ham died on the 24th of April 1975 in Surrey. Badfinger, Come and Get It.
alternative information-based radio broadcasting to the people who really listen to shortwave. This is Radio Facts, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
And now something from the BBC Radio 4 programme, The Radio Programme. Here's Laurie Taylor.
Hello. At the moment, this little bit of rather scratchy broadcasting is thoroughly illegal. London Greek Radio, one of the many pirate stations which stayed on air despite the Home Secretary's insistence earlier this year that those who continued to broadcast before the granting of community licences would be barred from holding such a licence. But like other pirate stations, LGR just wasn't prepared to stay silent until the end of 1989, the likely date for the granting of those licences. Then, at the end of last week, unexpected news. The Home Office capitulated and announced in advance of the White Paper that they'd allow the IBA to grant 20 community radio licences. I asked the spokesman for London Greek Radio, Dr. Xanatos Tafalis, what it felt like after 5 years of piracy to be on the verge of being legal.
Well, my reaction is that we'll apply for a licence. We are optimistic, we are hopeful. And based on the five-year experience and service we offer to the community, I hope we'll get a license.
It means, doesn't it, that you're going to have to come off the air probably by January the 1st, otherwise you're not going to be allowed to bid for a license.
Yes, we will stop so that we will abide by the laws. We're not just a pirate station who have been
going on. But you did take a chance by going on broadcasting after the Home Secretary had said that.
Yes, I think we have to. You don't give up. And then the government will realise that what we are doing for 5 years, it was the right thing.
Are you going to get one of these community stations? I wonder how you rate your chances, because there's only 20 stations on offer, and you've got quite a lot of competitors, because I understand that the independent local stations, they're going to be able to bid for these community stations. I mean, are you confident?
Yes, I'm confident, and I think it will be a great mistake if they grant licenses to these big businesses and established institutions, and they don't give a license to the Greek community, which is a very large community, and there is a desperate need for a Greek community radio.
Dr. Xanatos Tafalis of London Greek Radio. And those much-coveted licenses are, we learn, likely to be handed out next March.
Professor Laurie Taylor there on what is described as an addict's guide to radio, the radio programme from BBC Radio 4.
From the Daily Telegraph, serious error in ITV levy cost Treasury £38 million, by Jane Tyne. ITV companies have escaped paying £38 million in taxation after a serious error in government calculations, the Commons Public Accounts Committee said yesterday. The mistake comes as stations are fighting yet another tax change, which they say will cripple their ability to produce high-cost drama. The government proposes to tax them on their base revenue rather than on profits. But the last change in the method of levy in 1986 effectively cost the Treasury £38 million over 2 years, according to the committee. It accused the Home Office of a serious error of judgment in its calculations to change the amount levied on domestic profits from 66.7% to 45%, and to introduce a levy on overseas sales of 22.5%. According to the committee, the object was to keep the total revenue the same, but in 1986-87, the £33 million levy payable by television companies was £19 million lower than it would have been under the old system. This was caused by a standstill in overseas sales and a surge in domestic profits due to improved advertising revenue. We consider the failure by the Home Office to test the proposed levy changes against available information, which indicated a substantial risk to the objectives of those changes, was a serious error of judgment, the report said. We accept the Home Office could not reasonably have forecast the full 20% increase in domestic advertising revenue, but we believe there was sufficient evidence of an upward trend in profits to warn it that the likely results of the changes would be to produce substantially less revenue under the previous arrangement. The error comes as the companies are campaigning against another tax change. Mr. Hurd, Home Secretary, has announced that in the future, ITV companies will have to pay a percentage of advertising revenue at progressive rates. The change from a levy on profits will prevent the current custom of ITV companies ploughing profits into high-cost drama for documentaries rather than pay it back to the government, the industry claims. ITV, which last year paid £87 million in taxation, may hear within weeks of the government decision.
Radio Promise Silences Pirates by Shyama Pereira in The Guardian. Pirate radio operators are preparing to pull the plugs after the Home Office finally agreed to grant community radio licences. Only 20 will be permitted initially, but broadcasters hope that successful pilot schemes will liberate the airwaves for hundreds of others. "This is excellent. I'm surprised they finally made up their minds," said Mr. George Heraclius of London Greek Radio. "We have been waiting 5 years for this. It will be interesting to see what demands are now made by the Independent Broadcasting Authority." At neighbouring Kiss FM, Mr. George Mack added, "It's wonderful news. It's going to be a wonderful Christmas this year. I shall be meeting with our shareholders to plan our application. I only hope that the licences will be going to the small outfits and not the capital radios of this world." The IBA, which will grant and oversee the licences, seemed as surprised as the pirates by the Home Office decision. Previous applications have been refused or deferred, and it was widely believed that the Home Secretary would again put off a decision, using the impending broadcasting white paper as an excuse. However, the speed of the venture is worrying the Community Radio Association, which fears that the licences would go to existing ILR radio stations or big conglomerates. Mr. Mark Jones of the CRA said, "The IBA has said it wants new people with new ideas doing new things in a new way. Small community groups may need more than a couple of months to raise the £50,000 or so that is needed to start a station. We hope they will not be penalised as a result." The IBA has had more than 200 inquiries about community radio franchises, the vast majority from ethnic radio stations. Officials are expected to thrash out details of type, size and area over the next few weeks, and invitations for applications are expected before the end of the year. But as the celebrations started in cellars and front rooms around the country last night, the Home Office warned that the operator of any pirate station who is convicted of broadcasting after January 1, 1989, will be barred from applying for a franchise for 5 years. A majority of pirate stations did come off the air when, in 1985, the Home Office considered the possibility of granting community radio licences. But after the decision was deferred at the last minute, they trickled back onto the airwaves. Last night, most appeared happy to shut up shop pending the IBA decisions. That's from The Guardian.
If a picture paints a thousand words, then why can't I paint you? The words will never show the you I've come to know. If a face could launch a thousand ships, then where am I to go? There's no tomorrow.
Information-based radio, broadcasting to the people who really listen to shortwave. This is Radio Facts, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime, with Holly Robson
and Trevor Brook.
Now to ProSound News. Why the IBA's proposal for 20 new experimental radio stations is wrong, written by Clive Warner. Applicants for local radio franchises are being dangled a carrot by the IBA, who are proposing 20 new experimental local stations. These are expected to have a bias towards ethnic or unique audiences, for instance, specialist music stations. They will cover small geographic areas. Somehow, it all sounds exactly like Leon Britton's plan for the original experiment. Under its proposal, applicants will own and operate their own transmitters and pay fees to cover the IBA's costs. Having experienced the methods adopted by the IBA when I was involved with setting up UK commercial stations, I imagine that these costs will not be insignificant. The AIRC, which represents the interests of the ILR contractors, has taken the view of total opposition to the IBA proposals, different to my own, in that they see the vested interests of their members being eroded by the new competition. In practice, what would happen should the experiment proceed? The IBA has stated quite openly that any new stations would start only after consultation and liaison with existing contractors for any given area. When my own group, Mutual Broadcasting, applied for the Solihull franchise, we found ourselves in direct competition with Heartland Radio. Two of the Heartland directors were also on the board of the BRMB. Its application was seen by ourselves as a blatant attempt to grab any new slice of cake that might be available, so eliminating any potential competition for BRMB's audience. It's not hard to imagine the result of consultation and liaison with the IBA and the BRMB for a new station. Somehow I think that the Heartland Group would end up running the new facility. This would no doubt be the case in other areas as well. Therefore, Mutual Broadcasting must go on record, and here I state our official viewpoint, that we oppose any attempt by the IBA to initiate this experiment. In our opinion, the Cable Authority should be the regulatory body for the new tier of stations, as provided for by the legislation to be enacted by the White Paper. The schedule for the new stations, according to our latest information, is as follows. 1. Release of the White Paper, November 1988. 2. Legislation, autumn 1989. And 3. First stations on the air in summer 1991. This is slower than we would like to have seen. There is room for a limited experiment right now, and this should be put in place under the auspices of the Cable Authority. I would like to make a counter-proposal to that of the IBA, that the Cable Authority should be authorised by the government to undertake a limited experiment of 30 low-power stations, transmission radius of 8 miles maximum, in stereo. Such stations to be free to raise funds in any way they wish, subject to the existing rules concerning political and religious sponsorship, and clean and decent advertising. Funding by local authorities should not be permitted. Applicants shall be free to own and operate their own transmission facilities, which shall be subject to a minimum performance specification equivalent to that of the BBC local radio stations or the ILR stations, whichever is the least stringent. The experiment shall run until the legislation in place to provide the full introduction of community radio, at which time the experimental stations must apply for full licensing in order to continue. Their performance to be assessed by the cable authority at that time as to the suitability regarding the continuation and or expansion of the service, taking local opinion into account, as well as the technical standards achieved and maintained. That article was written by Clive Warner, who is the MD of Solihull-based Digital Matrix Limited and Technical Director of Mutual Broadcasting, set up to obtain a franchise for the Solihull area community radio station. He has in fact previously worked for the BBC, Capital Radio, Piccadilly Radio, as well as Marconi.
Fear of targets in broadcasting. In a letter to the Times from Mr. Rob McLaughlin. Dear Sir, in today's editorial, you state that the needs of advertisers have long been the most neglected in the broadcasting debate, and you point out that they lost the battle to advertise on the BBC. If you are welcoming an era where broadcasters will only make programmes which deliver the right target audience demanded by the advertiser, then you are betraying an important principle which has sustained British commercial broadcasting for 32 years, that advertisers buy airtime but do not influence or dictate the content of programmes. So far, commercial broadcasters have been freed from the fear that a controversy or revelatory programme could cost them thousands, if not millions, in lost revenue. Will that fear become too overpowering to allow certain types of programming in the future? Broadcasters do welcome the expansion of television and radio, but we also want to make sure that the BBC flourishes and that ITV or Channel 3 and Channel 4 are allowed to provide a range of good quality, popular and minority programming in the years to come. Satellite and cable television do not threaten this directly. Tampering with the financial base of ITV and the BBC does. As you state, the television revolution may provide a significant boost for the economy, but the American experience suggests that pleasing the advertiser often limits the range of programmes on offer to the viewer. Yours faithfully, Rob McLaughlin, Wood Road, Manchester 33, in a letter to the Times.
The Guardian reports Channel 5 on the air by 1993. A new independent channel, Channel 5, will come on stream in 1993, at the same time as the Channel 3 licences begin, allocated by the proposed Independent Television Commission. A sixth channel is also contemplated. As the country moves towards a more competitive, multi-channel broadcasting market, the existing regime for ITV is seen as becoming increasingly hard to sustain. It would be even less viable to try and make all new services conform to the present requirements of the ITV system. As viewers exercise greater choice, there is no longer the same need for the quality of services to be prescribed by legislation or regulatory fiat, the White Paper says. Channel 5 on UHF will enlarge the choice of a majority of viewers and should bring significant relief to the advertising market, although operators will be able to determine their own mix between advertising and subscription. It will cover about 70% of the country, sufficient to justify allocation of the scarce frequencies. Licences should be national in scope, and the channel could be split into two or more licences covering different parts of the day and night. This process would promote competition and enhance diversity. It will be for the ITC to decide how these segments should be arrived at. Channel 5 licensees, like those for Channel 3, will be required to broadcast accurate, impartial and high-quality news and current affairs coverage at suitable times in their schedules.
Microwave television may rival cable channels, by Mary Fagan, technology correspondent in The Independent. Microwave television could challenge emerging satellite services and existing cable television if it is introduced on time. According to a report published by the Department of Trade and Industry, microwave television, delivering television channels direct to customers over relatively short-range radio links, could technically become a national service offering up to 30 channels to more than 70% of the population of the UK. The report, produced by consultants Touche Ross on behalf of the DTI, is part of a series of studies leading up to the government white paper on broadcasting due before the end of the year. The cable television industry has lobbied for the introduction of microwave television, known as MVDS, as an interim measure, as it would allow them to deliver signals the last leg of the journey to the subscriber's home without the expense of digging up the roads. While Touche Ross concludes that such a use would be a boost to the cable television companies, it says it also offers potential for national coverage, including local or regional television services. MVDS offers the capability to carry as many as 30 extra television channels at whatever frequency is adopted. Besides these, it could carry other signals, such as high-definition television, digital sound radio, and computer data traffic, either nationally or locally, it states. If low frequencies, for which technology is already available, were used, microwave channels could be introduced by 1991. Touche Ross believes that with just 15% take-up of the population covered by microwave television, the capital cost of consumer equipment could be as low as £230. And some more work for these consultants, Touche Ross, announced in Electronic Times. Private airwaves. Private firms look likely to be responsible for carving up the radio spectrum in the future, and a study has been commissioned by Department of Trade and Industry to see how it should be done. Management consultant Touche Ross has been given the job of assessing whether privately run frequency planning organisations, FPOs, could be commercially successful in managing the airwaves. That's a revival of a concept which was introduced by a CSP International report produced for the DTI some 2 years ago, which created an enormous amount of fuss amongst the Radio Society of Great Britain and various other users of the radio spectrum when this concept of commercially operated frequency planning organisations was introduced. Whether any of the people at Touche Ross, CSP International, or indeed the DTI administration would recognise any part of the radio spectrum if sat in front of a radio set blindfold is quite another matter, completely irrelevant to these subjects, of course.
And now to something completely different. The Sunday Times reports TV guides set to lose monopoly, written by Jonathan Miller. Britain's two biggest-selling magazines, the Radio Times and the TV Times, could lose their monopoly on television listings by Christmas. The European Commission has informed broadcasters that it intends to order them to license their listings to all comers, and this has set off a race in the publishing industry to produce the first comprehensive programme guide. The preliminary judgment of the EC's Directorate General for Competition is being sent to member states for comment. Brian Cassidy, Euro MP for Dorset East and Hampshire West, said the formal decision may be published before the end of the year. The ruling follows a 2-year investigation into the restrictive agreements protecting Radio Times and TV Times from competition, and claims that the broadcasters have abused their dominant market position in violation of the Treaty of Rome. It says BBC and ITV must license their listings to all comers on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. A flood of new television guides is already being planned by Britain's publishing industry, some to be sold on newsstands and others to be free with newspapers. This week, a coalition of publishers, including News International, EMAP, IPC, The Daily Telegraph, The Independent, The Guardian, Evening Standard, Birmingham Post, Associated Magazines and Time Out, will launch a campaign to pressure the government to end the monopoly. They will lobby for the abolition to be included in the broadcasting bill due to be placed before next session of Parliament. The last big attempt to break the monopoly was in 1982, when Time Out, the London listings magazine, was successfully sued by the BBC and ITV for publishing their full schedules. The publishers now believe the time is ripe to renew their attack because of the imminent explosion in TV channels, approved by the Cabinet last week. They will argue that if the monopoly is not ended, consumers will have to buy three or more programme guides each week. The monopoly claims the monopoly prevents the development of a potentially huge market, which could generate a turnover of hundreds of millions of pounds annually and create thousands of new jobs. The British public is being ripped off every week of the year by the listings monopolists, a spokesman for the publishers said last night. Radio Times and TV Times are understood to have discussed the possibility of merging if they are ordered to share their listings with outsiders. But this approach is understood to be opposed by some senior executives at TV Times, including Richard Barber, the editor. He said that if the monopoly ended, TV Times would immediately become a four-channel magazine. Publicly, the BBC and ITV officials say they will fight to preserve the present position. But privately, senior executives admit that it is only a matter of time before they will have to compete in the new market.
One of our listeners wrote to us saying, could we repeat the address for Medium Wave News, which is a publication that's of interest to people who aren't at all interested in Medium Wave because they also give the Friedrichsberg A and K solar indices. And the address to get Medium Wave News publication from is Harold Emblem, 137A, Hampton Road, Southport, PR8, 5DY.
Had white horses and ladies by the score, all dressed in satin and waiting by the door. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Ooh, feathers, they made up his bed, a gold-covered mattress on which he was led. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Thank you.
If you get used to listening to AM signals through a synchronous detector, you will find it quite painful if you have to go back to an envelope detector. The improvement in signal-to-noise ratio and reduction in chatter from adjacent stations is particularly helpful on weak or fading signals. We produce a complete boxed phase-lock synchronous detector, which accepts 455 kHz IF input to suit many receivers. The two audio line level outputs can be fed into a hi-fi stereo system, and the four front panel controls allow reception of double sideband, upper sideband, lower sideband, stereo spread or independent sideband with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and improves the audibility of weaker co-channel signals, and finally, a low distortion envelope detector. Apart from all this, there is also an audio level controller, which counteracts the objectionable surging in loudness as the carrier goes through a selective fade and the automatic gain control in the receiver unnecessarily increases the gain. The unit costs £150, and a detailed four-page information sheet is available if you send along one 14p British stamp or one international reply coupon to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG.
A couple of weeks ago, we at Radio Fax issued a press release which has received some coverage in the trade press. For your interest, here's a few extracts from it. In response to the application for a radio broadcasting licence made to the Independent Broadcasting Authority in October of this year, Lord Thompson of Monifieth, chairman of the IBA, personally responded as follows. He regrets the IBA is unable to help with a licence under present legislation. The IBA can only transmit local sound broadcasting, whereas Radio Fax's intention is to cover the British Isles. He urges Radio Fax to press the Home Office to address the HF aspect, as it has not featured in any discussions the IBA have had with Home Office officials. He wishes Radio Fax luck with its exciting project. We have had a meeting with the DTI, and they agree that Radio Fax is operated in a legal way. What we need now is the remaining item in the chain, the transmitter in this country. We're interested in any form of approval which will allow us to provide a service from England.
Radio Fax will finish in December. We have been on the air for 3 months, and through that time you have been sending us over 100 letters each week telling us how much this kind of speech programming is appreciated. We also know that we have a fair number of very enthusiastic blind listeners. So we remain a legal operation and close down in December unless some government writes us out the licence we have been asking for since 3 years ago. What would the other possible options be? We could stay on the air from the Republic of Ireland, or we could come on the air from England. By making public the time and place, this would be a fairly straightforward act of civil disobedience, and the presumably inevitable court case would form part of the history of broadcasting. If hundreds of you write to say that is what you think we should do, then I suppose we would have to consider it seriously. But we have to make it clear now that these are not options we regard as compatible with a professional operation.
The letters you send are what has made this project worthwhile, and thank you again to everybody who's taken the trouble to write. We get letters from people aged between 17 and 70, and anyone in the media world will know that something appealing to such an age range is most unusual. Some of the historical items we've carried, the development of magnetic tape, the story of radar, old BBC transmitting stations, the inventions of magnetic recording, from wire recorders to digital tape and others, have brought in letters from people involved in the work of up to 50 years ago. If we were staying on the air, one thing we would have liked to do was organise a contact point so that people who worked together years and years ago could get in touch with each other again.
One thing we have achieved might be the most listened to programme per watt transmitted. And we mean listened to. Many shortwave stations are heard and logged, but your letters make it clear that people do listen to Radio Facts.
The use of shortwaves has fallen significantly over the last 20 years, and everyone seems agreed that, with a view to the future, what Radio Facts has demonstrated is now a useful and appropriate use of 9 kHz of the spectrum. What can you do? Well, if you think that Radio Facts or something like it should be offered a licence, you could write to your Member of Parliament at the House of Commons, London SW1A OAA. And the ministers responsible are Douglas Hurd and Timothy Renton at the Home Office, Queen Anne's Gate, London, SW1H 9AT.
You are the people who know it is rubbish to say that no frequencies are available. There are a greater number of you using the HF spectrum for education and recreation than all other users put together. So your voice should carry some weight in decisions about what some fraction of it is used for.
And now to some of your letters. We've heard from Colin Crabb, who comes from Birmingham, and he writes, "I was very disappointed to hear that you'll be closing down sometime in December. I've been a Radio Facts addict for over the last 2 months or so, and will find the resulting gap in broadcast listening made by your station's untimely departure difficult to fill. Judging by your correspondence slot, there are obviously many other enthusiastic supporters of Radio Facts, and I, for one, will be writing to my MP to elect his support in obtaining a licence for your continued operation." Well, Colin, that's great. Thanks a lot for the support.
And a letter from Penrith in Cumbria. "I'm very sorry to hear that Radio Facts will have to close down shortly, as I find your programmes very informative and of great benefit to me, as I am returning to shortwave listening after a long absence. Certainly, I would be willing to write to my Member of Parliament or the Home Secretary in support of your case for a licence. Should you be forced to transmit from abroad, I am sure that I and many others amongst a growing audience will continue to listen to your excellent station. In great appreciation of your station, I remain yours sincerely, Geoffrey Holden, from Carlton, Penrith, Cumbria."
Up to Scotland and from Aberdeenshire, we've heard from Anthony Thompson. "Dear Radio Facts, what a shame I didn't come across you much earlier, and what an even greater shame that you'll be forced to close down in December. I found out about your service through messages left in mailboxes throughout the UK on the amateur radio packet network. I've mainly listened on 6205, and as your promo says, people do listen, not just log your station. We do suffer in this part of northeast Scotland. Once the BBC World Service comes on later in the day, their sideband splatter is pretty deafening. Thanks very much for your letter, Anthony."
And now a letter from Australia reporting reception of Radio Facts in New Zealand. "My listening location was near Invercargill, New Zealand. You can imagine my surprise at hearing this signal, especially having in mind that your transmitter power is most likely to be quite low. I was in New Zealand from the 16th to the 25th of October to attend the 40th anniversary celebrations and AGM of the New Zealand Radio DX League, held in the South Island city of Invercargill. Here in Melbourne, I am a founding member of the radio club DX Australia and edit the monthly bulletin DX's Calling. Thank you from Harry Weatherly from Mount Waverley, Victoria, Australia."
Well, it was a surprise to us to hear that we were being picked up that far afield. And now it's back home again to Gosport in Hampshire, and a letter from Robert Foote. "Many thanks for the continuing excellence of your transmissions on Radio Facts. I've been listening since the end of August and find the vast majority of your output extremely interesting. May I thank you again and hope sincerely that you will somehow be able to continue broadcasting after the end of the year. Thank you, Robert Foote."
Mr. C. Varley from South Shore, Blackpool, Lancashire writes, "I'm writing to thank you for your most interesting and informative broadcasts, which I have enjoyed listening to for the past months. Every best wish with your application to get licensed and stay on the air from next year when the Republic's attitude to the airwaves gets tough. You have proved to countless people who listen on shortwave that you can do more with the medium than just beam rebroadcasts of domestic programming. I have learned a lot from your many good features on broadcasting technology and developments in science. I first found your programmes in July, and since then I listen to your reports when I know a new one has been prepared. I have especially enjoyed your features on the technology of transmission, this weekend's extract from the National Geographic on Alexander Graham Bell's life, and the features of last midweek on the control of satellite broadcasting have been very interesting. Once again, thank you, and please give my best wishes to Holly and Trevor, who do really sterling work for Real Radio. The BBC should be able to allow some competition on its HF frequencies. Once again, best wishes to all at the station. Clive Varley from Blackpool.
Over to the Netherlands, and a letter from Wyen Stenstra. I hope I haven't got that too wrong. He says that the nearest bus stop is still 7 kilometres from his house, so he's way out in the sticks. The nearest pillar box is at a distance of 3 kilometres, so I think you can say my location is an ideal one for DXing.
Well, thank you for walking to that pillar box, and thank you for your informative programme. Your signal strength was very good in Finland, says Mika Harkas from Velkua in Finland.
Over to Czechoslovakia now, and we've heard from Jiri Prokop. He says, I have pleasure in submitting a report on your broadcast received here in Czechoslovakia. This is the first time I have your radio station, and I enjoyed the experience.
And from Julius Hermans in Vleuten, Holland, I quite regularly tune into Radio Facts as you bring very interesting media information. Sometimes it's a bit too technical for me, but many items are very interesting.
Back to Kempston in Bedfordshire, England this time, and we've heard from Colin, who says, I hope that you'll be able to keep broadcasting for as long as possible. I often tune in and listen for half an hour or so, and normally find something of interest. I've even set one of my 10 memories to 6205 kilohertz. That's Colin Ferris from Kempston in Bedfordshire.
The content on hi-fi specifications versus audibility was very interesting, says G.H. Baker from Romford in Essex, England.
Over to Sweden now, and a letter from Tor Larsen, who says, many, many thanks for your transmission. It was really nice to tune into your station. Best regards from Falköping, Sweden, to all of you at Radio Facts.
Thank you for your letter, J.M. Wilson from Cheadle-Hume in Cheshire, England, and Callum MacLeod, Isle of Lewis in Scotland, says, for the past several weeks I have been listening regularly to your broadcasts on 6205 and have found them both interesting and informative and a refreshing change from the usual shortwave stations.
And thanks to DJ Hall of Colne in Lancashire, England, for writing to us, as well as to Philip Kellingley, who comes from Basingstoke in Hampshire, England. Now to an article from the Daily Telegraph. Lloyd Webber plans station to rival Radio 3. Mr. Andrew Lloyd Webber, the composer, announced plans for a London-based classical music station to rival Radio 3. It was one of the first responses to government proposals that commercial radio should develop to compete with the BBC. Mr. Lloyd Webber's entertainments group, The Really Useful Company, announced it would bid for one of the 20 new community radio licenses being issued by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. The service, covering popular classical music, news, financial reports and the arts, is to be called Classics FM. Unlike the new national stations, the community licences will not be issued by competitive tender, but on grounds of local relevance and suitability for the community. Yesterday, the IBA said it intended to issue the licences by the spring. It has already indicated that some will go to stations catering for ethnic and specialist interests. I wonder if that includes Radio Facts. The Really Useful Company has contracted a number of programme advisers, including Dame Kiri de Kanawa, Mr. Henley Wrong, Director of the Barbican Centre, and Lady Christie, Director of Glyndebourne Opera.
In the Financial Times, television satellite launched amid doubts by Paul Betts in Paris. France's controversial direct broadcasting television satellite, TDF1, has been successfully launched into orbit by the European Ariane space rocket, although the French government has yet to find operators to take all the five channels on the satellite. So far, only the new French state cultural channel, La Sept, has committed itself to the satellite. But the French authorities are negotiating with other French and European television networks to operate the four remaining channels on the satellite. After considerable hesitation, the socialist government decided to go ahead with the satellite programme, which has already absorbed more than 2 billion French francs, £187 million, in public funds over the last 10 years. The French authorities, as well as the French broadcasting and consumer electronics industries, backed the satellite, claiming it would give a big boost to the new European D2MAC television standard and prepare the way for European high-definition television. France is now due to launch a second TDF direct broadcasting satellite as a backup to TDF1 next year. Overall, the French satellite programme is expected to cost about 3.8 billion francs. The French direct broadcasting satellite is expected to reach 400 million television viewers from North Africa to Scandinavia.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy. Knowing I come to watch your flowers growing, ain't you got no rhymes for me? Do it and do do, feeling groovy, 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 feeling groovy. I got no deeds to do, no promises to keep. Let the morning time drop all its petals on me. Life, I love you, all is good.
Radio Fax, 6205 daytime and 1611 nighttime.
A week or two ago, we read out a letter which was in Electronics Weekly, quoting Bev Marks. And it seemed to us at the time that it was something being quoted out of context. Now there's a letter to the magazine. Your article on the radio data system, captioned BBC makes false RDS claims, is untrue. This is from David C. Lees, Manager, Engineering Promotions, BBC Engineering Information Department. The comments relating to the audibility of RDS in use have no bearing on the RDS services in Europe from the BBC, IBA and other broadcasters, only on the design of an RDS receiver over which the broadcasters have no control. The article also shows clearly to all that your writers and editors have no first-hand experience of RDS. The BBC has many years' experience with RDS. In dynamic listening tests, the auto-tuning operation of properly designed RDS radio receivers is barely perceptible and is usually not noticed at all. I suggest you try this yourself. If an RDS radio delays the auto-tuning operation until the held signal is noticeably noisy, there will, of course, be a marked improvement in audio quality at the time of the retune. However, most manufacturers implementing RDS would choose to design the radio to carry out a clean auto-tune function. David Lees, BBC Engineering Information Department.
Now, here's a good one from the Daily Mail. The pirate who put village in picture gets a poor reception. Electronics wizard Robin Parker started his own pirate TV and radio stations because the reception in his tiny village was so poor. He spent £3,000 on TV and radio transmitting equipment, then videotaped BBC and ITV programmes and rebroadcast them to the 900 inhabitants. His service included old films and his own local weather forecasts. He also ran up to 8 radio stations, 1 pop channel, and had a transmitter in every room of his cottage with 7 aerials on the roof. Parker, who is 42, modelled himself on comedian Lenny Henry's TV character Delbert Wilkins, who broadcasts from the back of a London caff. But his pirate empire crashed when the Trade Department inspector raided his 4-bedroomed home and found him putting out a play school repeat. Yesterday, Parker of Little Haven Cottage, Tedburn St Mary near Exeter, admitted 3 charges of installing illegal transmitters and 3 of using them. He was given a conditional discharge after Wonford magistrates in Exeter heard a plea from the Reverend David Werner, the village rector. But Mr Parker's equipment was seized and he was ordered to pay £300 costs. Mr. Werner said, "I get round the parish and hear people talk. They all knew about the radio stations and thought they were great fun." He says the village is in a valley and has always suffered from poor reception. Most people have had to buy special aerials and signal amplifiers for their TVs. Parker, who is unemployed, bought most of his electronic gear from high street stores. His broadcasting range was just 3 miles. After the case, he said, "I've taken up CB radio, but I'm looking forward to seeing the white paper on broadcasting. I hope there may be a way to get back on the air legally." He admitted his ambition was to be a Radio 1 disc jockey, saying, "I've mastered the patter, and I think I've got what it takes." Last night, an IBA spokesman said, "We would like to provide a new mast and transmitter, but the problem is a shortage of frequencies in the area."
Output will be subject to less stringent controls. In The Guardian by Seamus Milne, new national radio stations. The White Paper confirms the government's proposals in January for at least 3 new national commercial radio stations alongside the BBC, combined with a much looser set of criteria for awarding licences at local level. Both national and local commercial radio services will be subject to a lighter regulatory regime. No group will be able to control more than 1 national service and more than 6 local stations. There will be a 20% limit on radio interests in newspapers and vice versa. All commercial stations will be subject to a radio authority, which will issue licences and regulate satellite radio services. Local cable franchises will be granted by the Independent Television Commission on a 15-year basis. The government does not propose to lay down specific coverage obligations on local franchise holders. Initially, only 1 franchise will be awarded in any one area. Applicants will first have to prove their financial soundness and technical competence, but thereafter the franchises will be awarded by competitive tender.
Again from The Guardian, why more must not also mean worse. What are the government's plans on new broadcasting legislation for? A broadcasting industry has been a twitter for 2 years waiting for its fate. Onlookers may have wondered during this long and edgy interregnum why this government was bothering with legislation, given what it has been achieved, what has been achieved without it. ITV companies are even now being totally restructured, jobs are shed, costs slashed. The BBC is under totally new management, warned that the licence fee is not immortal, and looking at all options short of spot advertising for enhancing its revenue. The concept of independent production, born in 1982 with Channel 4, is being forcibly injected into the ITV and BBC systems, not necessarily for the worse. Lord Rees-Mogg and his Broadcasting Standards Council are in place. So is a new dictate on the coverage of Northern Ireland. Nor did the Independent Broadcasting Authority and Cable Authority have to wait until yesterday to know they were all doomed. All without so much as a by your leave to producer, consumer or parliament. On top of which, spirits are strutting the airwaves over whom no government has control. Direct-to-home satellite television having been agreed by international convention. All any single state can do is to strive to make the best of it. So, if we're to have major legislation now, what should be its purpose? Simply to create the framework in which the viewing public gets the very best service that can be contrived. Broadcasting, and particularly television, plays an important and complex role in our national life. And it is a matter of record that Britain thus far has made better of it in terms of range quality than anywhere else, while in terms of quantity outdoing all but a few. So, will the white paper enhance the cultural role, improve the range and quality, as the Conservative-created C4 undoubtedly has done, or diminish it? It will increase the quantity, as it had to. No government at this time could stand against the arrival of satellite channels. Given that if the possibility of a terrestrial Channel 5 exists, why not allow it into play? Let the entrepreneurs test their judgments of what the public really wants, as in the print culture. In such an environment, the need for ITV to adjust follows automatically. Much of the contents of the white paper, therefore, are logically inevitable as to make the long wait, 2.5 years since the Peacock Committee's report and a year behind schedule, ridiculous. The fact is that Mrs. Thatcher, Lord Young and some of their market ideology chums have been on a very long learning curve to the realisation that the total consumer marketplace of pay-as-you-view is neither technically within reach or politically an unalloyed joy. But still, they cannot bring themselves to address the central issue, the cultural role. Mr. Douglas Hurd makes soothing noises about standards and may believe himself. The government's internal conflict at least has been resolved in favour of ITV retaining a regional presence and a national news system. But it remains hard to see the tendering proposals for the next franchise round as more than a way of making short-term gains for the Treasury, which by definition implies not just the end of Mrs. Thatcher's last bastion of restrictive practices, which is good, but minimised resources for programmes, which is dangerous. Whoever holds an ITV franchise from 1993 will be sitting pretty, well able to make a bob or two million against the new media opposition and increasingly strapped BBC. The great risk of government's plans is that it will be delivering this major system into the hands of single-minded, narrow-minded moneymen. They, in turn, will appoint their own sort of programme people.